Disc 2.
After dinner, Louis Sericold and Dr. Maverick went away to the latter's office. The occupational therapist and the schoolmasters went away to some lair of their own. The three cases went back to the college. Gina and Stephen went to the theatre to discuss Gina's idea for a set. Mildred knitted an indeterminate garment, and Miss Bellever darned socks. Wally sat in a chair, gently tilted backwards, and stared into space. Carrie Louise and Miss Marple talked about old days. The conversation seemed strangely unreal. Edgar Lawson alone seemed unable to find a niche. He sat down and then got up restlessly. "I wonder if I ought to go to Mr. Sericold," he said rather loudly. "He may need me." Carrie Louise said gently, "Oh, I don't think so. He was going to talk over one or two points with Dr. Maverick this evening." "Oh, then I certainly won't butt in. I shouldn't dream of going where I wasn't wanted. I've already wasted time today going down to the station when Mrs. Hudd meant to go herself." "Oh, she ought to have told you," said Carrie Louise. "But I think she just decided at the last moment. You do realize, Mrs. Sericold, that she made me look a complete fool. A complete fool." "Oh, no, no," said Carrie Louise, smiling. "You mustn't have these ideas. Now, I know I'm not needed or wanted. I'm perfectly aware of that. If things had been different, if I'd had my proper place in life, it would be very different. Very different indeed. It's no fault of mine that I haven't got my proper place in life." "Now, Edgar," said Carrie Louise, "don't work yourself up about nothing. Jane thinks it was very kind of you to meet her. Gina always has these sudden impulses. She didn't mean to upset you." "Oh, yes, she did. It was done on purpose, to humiliate me." "Oh, Edgar, you don't know half what's going on, Mrs. Sericold. Well, I won't say any more now, except good night." Edgar went out, shutting the door with a slam behind him. Miss Bellever snorted. "Oh, atrocious manners." "Oh, he's so sensitive," said Carrie Louise vaguely. Mildred Street clicked her needles and said sharply, "He really is a most odious young man. You shouldn't put up with such behaviour, Mother." "Well, Louis says he can't help it," Mildred said sharply. "Everyone can help behaving rudely. Of course, I blame Gina very much. She's so completely scatterbrained in everything she undertakes. She does nothing but make trouble. One day she encourages this young man, and the next day she snubs him. And what can you expect?" Wally Hudd spoke for the first time that evening. He said, "That guy's crackers. That's all there is to it. Crackers." In her bedroom that night, Miss Marple tried to review the pattern of Stony Gates, but it was as yet too confused. There were currents and cross-currents here, but whether they could account for Ruth Van Rydock's uneasiness, it was impossible to tell. It did not seem to Miss Marple that Carrie Louise was affected in any way by what was going on round her. Stephen was in love with Gina. Gina might or might not be in love with Stephen. Walter Hudd was clearly not enjoying himself. These were incidents that might and did occur in all places and at most times. There was, unfortunately, nothing exceptional about them. They ended in the divorce court, and everybody hopefully started again, when fresh tangles were created. Mildred Street was clearly jealous of Gina, and disliked her. That, Miss Marple thought, was very natural. She thought over what Ruth Van Rydock had told her. Carrie Louise's disappointment at not having a child, the adoption of little Pippa, and then the discovery that, after all, a child was on the way. "Often happens like that," Miss Marple's doctor had told her. "Relief of tension, maybe, and then nature can do its work." He had added that it was usually hard lines on the adopted child. But that had not been so in this case. Both Gulbranson and his wife had adored little Pippa. She had made her place too firmly in their hearts to be lightly set aside. Gulbranson was already a father. Paternity meant nothing new to him. Carrie Louise's maternal yearnings had been assuaged by Pippa. Her pregnancy had been uncomfortable, and the actual birth difficult and prolonged. Possibly Carrie Louise, who had never cared for reality, did not enjoy her first brush with it. There remained two little girls growing up, one pretty and amusing, the other plain and dull. Which, again, Miss Marple thought, was quite natural. For when people adopt a baby girl, they choose a pretty one. And though Mildred might have been lucky and taken after the Martins, who had produced handsome Ruth and dainty Carrie Louise, nature elected that she should take after the Gulbransons, who were large and stolid and uncompromisingly plain. Moreover, Carrie Louise was determined that the adopted child should never feel her position, and in making sure of this, she was overindulgent to Pippa, and sometimes less than fair to Mildred. Pippa had married and gone away to Italy, and Mildred, for a time, had been the only daughter of the house. But then Pippa had died, and Carrie Louise had brought Pippa's baby back to Stony Gates, and once more Mildred had been out of it. There had been the new marriage, the Restrick boys. In 1934, Mildred had married Canon Street, a scholarly antiquarian about 15 years her senior, and had gone away to live in the south of England. Presumably she'd been happy, but one did not really know. There had been no children. And now here she was, back again in the same house where she had been brought up. And once again, Miss Marple thought, not particularly happy about it. Gina, Stephen, Wally, Mildred, Miss Bellaver, who liked an orderly routine and was unable to enforce it, Louis Sericold, who was clearly blissfully and wholeheartedly happy, an idealist able to translate his ideals into practical measures. In none of these personalities did Miss Marple find what Ruth's words had led her to believe she might find. Carrie Louise seemed secure, remote at the heart of the whirlpool, as she had been all her life. What, then, in that atmosphere, had Ruth felt to be wrong? Did she, Jane Marple, feel it also? What of the outer personalities of the whirlpool? The occupational therapists, the schoolmasters, earnest, harmless young men, confident young Dr. Maverick, the three pink-faced, innocent-eyed young delinquents, Edgar Lawson. And here, just before she fell asleep, Miss Marple's thoughts stopped and revolved speculatively round the figure of Edgar Lawson. Edgar Lawson reminded her of someone or something. There was something a little wrong about Edgar Lawson, perhaps more than a little. Edgar Lawson was maladjusted, that was the phrase, wasn't it? But surely that didn't and couldn't touch Carrie Louise. Mentally, Miss Marple shook her head. What worried her was something more than that. Chapter 5. Gently eluding her hostess the next morning, Miss Marple went out into the gardens. Their condition distressed her. They had once been an ambitiously set out achievement. Clumps of rhododendrons, smooth slopes of lawns, massed borders of herbaceous plants, clipped box hedges surrounding a formal rose garden. Now all was largely derelict, the lawns raggedly mown, the borders full of weeds with tangled flowers struggling through them, the paths moss-covered and neglected. The kitchen gardens, on the other hand, enclosed by red brick walls, were prosperous and well-stocked. That, presumably, was because they had been a utility value. So also, a large portion of what had once been lawn and flower garden was not fenced off and laid out in tennis courts and a bowling green. Surveying the herbaceous border, Miss Marple clicked her tongue vexedly and pulled up a flourishing plant of groundsel. As she stood with it in her hand, Edgar Lawson came into view. Seeing Miss Marple, he stopped and hesitated. Miss Marple had no mind to let him escape. She called him briskly. When he came, she asked him if he knew where any gardening tools were kept. Edgar said vaguely that there was a gardener somewhere who would know. "It's such a pity to see this border so neglected," twittered Miss Marple. "I'm so fond of gardens." And since it was not her intention that Edgar should go in search of any necessary implement, she went on quickly, "It's about all an old and useless woman can find to do. Now, I don't suppose you ever bother your head about gardens, Mr. Lawson. You have so much real and important work to do. Being in a responsible position here with Mr. Sericold, you must find it all most interesting." He answered quickly, almost eagerly, "Yes, yes, it is interesting. And you must be of the greatest assistance to Mr. Sericold." His face darkened. "I don't know. I can't be sure. It's what's behind it all." He broke off. Miss Marple watched him thoughtfully. A pathetic, undersized young man in a neat dark suit. A young man that few people would look at twice, or remember if they did look. There was a garden seat nearby, and Miss Marple drifted towards it and sat. Edgar stood frowning in front of her. "I'm sure," said Miss Marple brightly, "that Mr. Sericold relies on you a great deal." "I don't know," said Edgar. "I really don't know." He frowned and almost absently sat down beside her. "I'm in a very difficult position." "Of course," said Miss Marple. The young man Edgar sat staring in front of him. "This is all highly confidential," he said suddenly. "Of course," said Miss Marple. "If I had my rights..." "Yes?" "I might as well tell you. You won't let it go any further, I'm sure." "Oh, no." She noticed he did not wait for her disclaimer. "My father... Actually, my father is a very important man." This time there was no need to say anything. She had only to listen. "Nobody knows except Mr. Sericold. You see, it might prejudice my father's position if the story got out." He turned to her. He smiled, a sad, dignified smile. "You see, I'm Winston Churchill's son." "Oh," said Miss Marple. "I see." And she did see. She remembered a rather sad story in St. Mary Mead, and the way it had gone. Edgar Lawson went on, and what he said had the familiarity of a stage scene. "There were reasons. My mother wasn't free. Her own husband was in an asylum. There could be no divorce, no question of marriage. I don't really blame them. At least I think I don't. I mean, he's done, always, everything he could. Discreetly, of course. And that's where the trouble has arisen. He's got enemies, and they're against me, too. They've managed to keep us apart. They watch me. Wherever I go, they spy on me. And they make things go wrong for me." Miss Marple shook her head. "Dear, dear," she said. "Now, in London, I was studying to be a doctor. They tampered with my exams. They altered the answers. They wanted me to fail. They followed me about the streets. They told things about me to my landlady. They hound me wherever I go." "Oh, but you can't be sure of that," said Miss Marple soothingly. "I tell you, I know. Oh, they're very cunning. I never get a glimpse of them or find out who they are, but I shall find out. Mr. Sericold took me away from London and brought me down here. He was kind, I'm very kind, but even here, you know, I'm not safe. They're here too, working against me, making the others dislike me. And Mr. Sericold says that isn't true, but Mr. Sericold doesn't know. Or else I wonder... Sometimes I've thought..." He broke off. He got up. "This is all confidential," he said. "You do understand that, don't you? But if you notice anyone following me, and spying, I mean, you might let me know who it is." He went away then, neat, pathetic, insignificant. Miss Marple watched him and wondered. A voice spoke. "Nuts," it said. "Just nuts." Wally Hudd was standing beside her. His hands were thrust deep in his pockets, and he was frowning as he stared after Edgar's retreating figure. "What kind of a joint is this, anyway?" he said. "They're all bughouse, the whole lot of them." Miss Marple said nothing, and Walter went on. "I mean, that Edgar guy. Hey, what you make of him? Says his father's really Lord Montgomery. Doesn't seem likely to me. I mean, not Monty. Not from all I've heard about him."
"No," said Miss Marple. "It doesn't seem very likely."
"I mean, he told Gina something quite different. Some bunk about being really the heir to the Russian throne. He said he was some Grand Duke's son or other. Hell, doesn't the chap know who his father really was?"
"Well, I should imagine not," said Miss Marple. "That is probably just the trouble."
Walter sat down beside her, dropping his body onto the seat with a slack movement. He repeated his former statement. "Ah, they're all bughouse here."
"You don't like being at Stony Gates?"
The young man frowned. "Well, I simply don't get it, that's all. I don't get it. I take this place, the house, the whole setup. They're rich, these people. They don't need dough. They've got it. And look at the way they live. Cracked antique china and cheap plain stuff all mixed up. No proper upper-class servants, just some casual hired help. Tapestries and drapes and chair covers, all satin and brocade and stuff. And it's falling to pieces. Big silver tea urns, and what do you know, all yellow and tarnished for want of cleaning. I mean, Mrs. Circle just doesn't care. I mean, look at that dress she had on last night. Darned under the arms, nearly worn out. And yet she could go to a store and order what she liked. Bond Street or whatever it is. Dough, they are rolling in dough." He paused and sat deliberating. "You know, I understand being poor. There's nothing much wrong with it. If you're young and strong and ready to work. Well, I never had much money, but I was all set to get where I wanted. I was going to open a garage. I'd got a bit of money put by. I talked to Gina about it. She listened. She seemed to understand. I didn't know much about her. All those girls in uniform, they all look about the same. I mean, you can't tell from looking at them who's got dough and who hasn't. I thought she was a cut above me, perhaps education and all that, but it didn't seem to matter. We fell for each other. We got married. I'd got my bit put by, and Gina had some too, she told me. We were going to set up a gas station back home, and Gina was willing. Just a couple of crazy kids, we were mad about each other. Then that snooty aunt of Gina's started making trouble. And Gina wanted to come here to England to see her grandmother. Well, that seemed fair enough. It was her home, and I was curious to see England anyway. I'd heard a lot about it, so we came. Just a visit. That's what I thought." The frown became a scowl. "But it hasn't turned out like that. We're caught up in this crazy business. Why don't we stay here, make our home here? That's what they say. Plenty of jobs for me. Jobs? I don't want a job feeding candy to gangster kids and helping them play at kids' games. And what's the sense of it all? I mean, this place could be swell, really swell. Don't people who've got money understand their luck? Don't they understand that most of the world can't have a swell place like this and that they've got one? I mean, isn't it plain crazy to kick your luck when you've got it? I don't mind working if I've got to. But I'll work the way I like and what I like. And I'll work to get somewhere. I mean, this place makes me feel I'm tangled up in a spider's web. And Gina... Gina, I can't make Gina out. She's not the same girl I married over in the States. I can't... Dang it all. I can't even talk to her now. Oh, hell." Miss Marple said gently, "I quite see your point of view." Wally shot a swift glance at her. "You're the only one I've shut my mouth off to so far. Most of the time I shut up like a clam. Yeah, I don't know what it is about you. You're English right enough. Really English. But in the darnedest way, you remind me of my Aunt Betsy back home.
Now that's very nice.
Well, a lot of sense she had, Wally continued reflectively. Looked as frail as though you could snap her in two, but actually she was tough, yes, sir. I'll say she was tough.
He got up.
Well, I'm sorry talking to you this way, he apologized.
For the first time, Miss Marple saw him smile. It was a very attractive smile, and Wally Hudd was suddenly transfigured from an awkward, sulky boy into a handsome and appealing young man.
Well, had to get things off my chest, I suppose. But too bad picking on you.
Oh, not at all, my dear boy, said Miss Marple. I have a nephew of my own, only, of course, a great deal older than you are. Her mind dwelt for a moment on the sophisticated modern writer Raymond West. A greater contrast to Wally Hudd could not have been imagined.
You've got other company coming, said Walter Hudd. That dame doesn't like me, so I'll quit. So long, ma'am. Thanks for the talk.
He strode away, and Miss Marple watched Mildred Street coming across the lawn to join her. I see you've been victimized by that terrible young man, said Mrs. Street rather breathlessly as she sank down on the seat. And what a tragedy it is.
A tragedy?
Oh, Gina's marriage. It all came about from sending her off to America. I told Mother at the time it was most unwise. After all, this is quite a quiet district. We had hardly any raids here. I do so dislike the way many people gave way to panic about their families. And themselves, too, very often.
Well, it must have been difficult to decide what was right to do, said Miss Marple thoughtfully. Where children were concerned, I mean. With the prospect of possible invasion, it might have meant their being brought up under a German regime, as well as the danger of bombs.
Oh, all nonsense, said Mrs. Street. I never had the least doubt we should win. Mother has always been quite unreasonable where Gina is concerned. The child was always spoilt and indulged in every way. There was absolutely no need to take her away from Italy in the first place.
Her father raised no objection, I understand.
Oh, San Severiano. You know what Italians are. Nothing matters to them but money. He married Pippa for her money, of course.
Dear me, I always understood he was very devoted to her and quite inconsolable at her death.
He pretended to be, no doubt. Why Mother ever countenanced her marrying a foreigner, I can't imagine. Just the usual American pleasure in a title, I suppose.
Miss Marple said mildly, I always thought that dear Carrie Louise was almost too unworldly in her attitude to life.
Oh, I know. I've no patience with it. Mother's fads and whims and idealistic projects. You've no idea, Aunt Jane, of all that it has meant. Now, I can speak with knowledge, of course. I was brought up in the middle of it all.
It was with a very faint shock that Miss Marple heard herself addressed as Aunt Jane, and yet that had been the convention of those times. Her Christmas presents to Carrie Lewis's children were always labelled with love from Aunt Jane, and as Aunt Jane they thought of her, when they thought of her at all, which was not, Miss Marple supposed, very often. She looked thoughtfully at the middle-aged woman sitting beside her, at the pursed tight mouth, the deep lines from the nose down, the hands tightly pressed together. She said gently,
You must have had a difficult childhood.
Mildred Street turned eager, grateful eyes to her.
Oh, I'm so glad that someone appreciates that. People don't really know what children go through. Pippa, you see, was the pretty one. She was older than I was, too. It was always she who got all the attention. Both father and mother encouraged her to push herself forward. Not that she needed any encouragement. To show off. I was always the quiet one. I was shy. Pippa didn't know what shyness was. A child can suffer a great deal, Aunt Jane.
I know that, said Miss Marple.
Mildred's so stupid. That's what Pippa used to say. But I was younger than she was. Naturally, I couldn't be expected to keep up with her in lessons. And it's very unfair on a child when her sister is always put in front of her.
"What a lovely little girl," people used to say to Mama. They never noticed me. It was Pippa that Papa used to joke and play with. Someone ought to have seen how hard it was on me, all the notice and attention going to her. I wasn't old enough to realise that it's character that matters. Her lips trembled, then hardened again. And it was unfair, really unfair. And I was their own child. Pippa was only adopted. I was the daughter of the house. She was nobody. Probably they were extra indulgent to her on that account, said Miss Marple. They liked her best, said Mildred Street, and added, a child whose parents didn't want her. Or probably, more probably, illegitimate. She went on. It's come out in Gina. There's bad blood there. Blood will tell. And Lewis can have what theories he likes about environment. Bad blood does tell. I mean, look at Gina. Gina's a very lovely girl, said Miss Marple. Hardly in behaviour, said Mrs. Street. Everyone but Mother notices how she's carrying on with Stephen Restrick. It's quite disgusting, I call it. Admittedly, she made a very unfortunate marriage, but marriage is marriage, and one should be prepared to abide by it. After all, she chose to marry that dreadful young man. Is he so dreadful? Oh, dear Aunt Jane. He really looks to me quite like a gangster, and so surly and rude. He hardly opens his mouth. And he always looks so raw and uncouth. He is unhappy, I think, said Miss Marple mildly. I really don't know why he should be, apart from Gina's behaviour, I mean. Everything's been done for him here. Lewis has suggested several ways in which he could try and make himself useful, but he prefers to skulk and do nothing. She burst out, Oh, this whole place is impossible, quite impossible. Lewis thinks of nothing but these horrible young criminals, and Mother thinks of nothing but him. Everything Lewis does is right. I mean, look at the state of the garden, the weeds, the overgrowth. And the house, nothing properly done. Oh, I know domestic staff is difficult nowadays, but it can be got. It's not as though there were any shortage of money. It's just that nobody cares. I mean, if it were my house... She stopped. I'm afraid, said Miss Marple, that we all have to face the fact that conditions are different. These large establishments are a great problem. It must be sad for you, in a way, to come back here and find everything so different. Do you really prefer living here to, well, somewhere of your own? Mildred Street flushed. After all, it's my home, she said. It was my father's house. Nothing can alter that. I've a right to be here if I choose, and I do choose. If only Mother were not so impossible. She won't even buy herself proper clothes. It worries Jolly a lot. I was going to ask you about Miss Bellever. Such a comfort having her here. She adores Mother. She's been with her a long time now. She came in John Resterick's time. And was wonderful, I believe, during the whole sad business. I expect you heard that he ran away with that dreadful Yugoslavian woman, a most abandoned creature. She'd had any amount of lovers, I believe. Mother was very fine and dignified about it all. Divorced him as quietly as possible. Even went so far as to have the Resterick boys for their holidays. Quite unnecessary, really. Other arrangements could have been made. It would have been unthinkable, of course, to have let them go to their father and that woman. Anyway, Mother had them here. And Miss Bellever stood by all through things and was a tower of strength. I sometimes think she makes Mother even more vague than she need be by doing all the practical things herself, but I really don't know what Mother would do without her. She paused and then remarked in a tone of surprise, Here is Lewis. How odd. He seldom comes out into the garden. Mr. Sericold came towards them in the same single-minded way that he did everything. He appeared not to notice Mildred, because it was only Miss Marple who was in his mind. Now, I'm so sorry, he said. I wanted to take you round our institution and show you everything. Caroline asked me to. Unfortunately, I have to go to Liverpool. The case of that boy in the railway parcels office. But Maverick will take you. He'll be here in a few minutes. I shan't be back until the day after tomorrow. It'll be splendid if we can get them not to prosecute. Mildred Street got up and walked away. Lewis Sericold did not notice her go,
His earnest eyes gazed at Miss Marple through thick glasses.
"You see," he said, "the magistrates nearly always take the wrong view. I mean, sometimes they're too severe, but sometimes they're too lenient. If these boys get a sentence of a few months, it's no deterrent. They get a kind of kick out of it, even. Boast about it to their girlfriends. But a severe sentence often sobers them. They realize that the game isn't worth it. Or else it's better not to serve a prison sentence at all. Corrective training, constructional training, like we have here." Miss Marple interrupted him.
"Mr. Sericold," she said, "are you quite satisfied about young Mr. Lawson? Is he quite normal?"
A disturbed expression appeared on Louis Sericold's face.
"I do hope he's not relapsing.
What has he been saying?"
"He told me that he was Winston Churchill's son."
"Oh, of course, of course. The usual statements. He's illegitimate, as you've probably guessed, poor lad, and of very humble beginnings. He was a case recommended to me by a society in London. He'd assaulted a man in the street who, he said, was spying on him. All very typical. I mean, Dr. Maverick will tell you. Well, I went into his case history. Mother was of a poor class, but a respectable family in Plymouth. Father a sailor, she didn't even know his name. Child brought up in difficult circumstances. Started romancing about his father, and later about himself. Wore uniforms and decorations he wasn't entitled to. I mean, all quite typical. But Maverick considers the prognosis hopeful. If we can give him confidence in himself. I've given him responsibility here, tried to make him appreciate it, that it's not a man's birth that matters, but what he is. I've tried to give him confidence in his own ability. The improvement was marked. I was very happy about him. And now you say..." He shook his head. "Mightn't he be dangerous, Mr. Sericold?" "Dangerous? I don't think he's shown any suicidal tendencies."
"No, I wasn't thinking of suicide. He talked to me of enemies, of persecution. Isn't that, forgive me, a dangerous sign?"
"I don't really think it has reached such a pitch, but I'll speak to Maverick. So far he's been hopeful, very hopeful." He looked at his watch. "Ah, I must go. Here's our dear Jolly. She'll take charge of you."
Miss Bellever, arriving briskly, said,
"The car is at the door, Mr. Sericold. Dr. Maverick rang through from the Institute. I said I would bring Miss Marple over. He'll meet us at the gates."
"Oh, thank you. I must go. My briefcase? In the car, Mr. Sericold."
Louis Sericold hurried away. Looking after him, Miss Bellever said,
"Some day that man will drop dead in his tracks. Against human nature never to relax or rest.
He only sleeps 4 hours a night."
"He is very devoted to this cause," said Miss Marple.
"Never thinks of anything else," said Miss Bellever grimly. "Never dreams of looking after his wife or considering her in any way. She's a sweet creature, as you know, Miss Marple, and she ought to have love and attention. But nothing's thought of or considered here except a lot of whining boys and young men who want to live easily and dishonestly and don't care about the idea of doing a little hard work. I mean, what about the boys from decent homes? Decent boys. Why isn't something done for them? Honesty just isn't interesting to cranks like Mr. Sericold and Dr. Maverick and all the bunch of half-baked sentimentalists we've got here. I and my brothers were brought up the hard way, Miss Marple, and we weren't encouraged to whine. Soft, that's what the world is nowadays."
They had crossed the garden and passed through a palisaded gate and come to the arched gate which Eric Gulbranson had erected as an entrance to his college, a sturdily built, hideous red brick building. Dr. Maverick, looking, Miss Marple decided, distinctly abnormal himself, came out to meet them.
"Oh, thank you, Miss Bellera," he said. "Now, Miss, oh, yes, Miss Marple, I'm sure you're going to be interested in what we're doing here, in our splendid approach to this great problem. Mr. Sericold is a man of great insight, great vision, and we've got Sir John Stillwell behind us, my old chief. He was at the Home Office until he retired, and his influence turned the scales in getting this started.
is a medical problem. That's what we've got to get the legal authorities to understand. A psychiatry came into its own in the war. One positive good that did come out of it. Now, first of all, I want you to see our initial approach to the problem. Look up. Miss Marple looked up at the words carved over the large arched doorway. Recover hope, all ye who enter here. Now, isn't that splendid? Isn't that just the right note to strike? You don't want to scold these lads or punish them. That's what they're hankering after half the time, punishment. We want to make them feel what fine fellows they are. Like Edgar Lawson, said Miss Marple. Interesting case, that. Have you been talking to him? He's been talking to me, said Miss Marple. She added apologetically, I wondered if, perhaps, he isn't a little mad. Dr. Maverick laughed cheerfully. We're all mad, dear lady, he said, as he ushered her in through the door. That's the secret of existence. We're all a little mad. Chapter 6. On the whole, it was a rather exhausting day. Enthusiasm in itself can be extremely wearing, Miss Marple thought. She felt vaguely dissatisfied with herself and her own reactions. There was a pattern here, perhaps several patterns, and yet she herself could obtain no clear glimpse of it or them. Any vague disquietude she felt centred round the pathetic but inconspicuous personality of Edgar Lawson. If only she could find in her memory the right parallel. Painstakingly, she rejected the curious behaviour of Mr. Selkirk's delivery van, the absent-minded postman, the gardener who worked on Whit Monday, and that very curious affair of the summer weight combinations. Something she could not quite put her finger on was wrong about Edgar Lawson. Something that went beyond the observed and admitted facts. But for the life of her, Miss Marple did not see how that wrongness, whatever it was, affected her friend Carrie Louise. In the confused patterns of life at Stony Gates, people's troubles and desires impinged on each other, but none of them, again, as far as she could see, impinged on Carrie Louise. Carrie Louise. Suddenly Miss Marple realized that it was she alone, except for the absent Ruth, who used that name. To her husband, she was Caroline. To Miss Belliver, Cara. Stephen Resterick usually addressed her as Madonna. To Wally, she was formerly Mrs. Sericold. And Gina elected to address her as Grandam, a mixture she had explained of Grand Dame and Grandmama. Was there some significance, perhaps, in the various names that were found for Caroline Louise Sericold? Was she to all of them a symbol, and not quite a real person? When, on the following morning, Carrie Louise, dragging her feet a little as she walked, came and sat down on the garden seat beside her friend and asked her what she was thinking about, Miss Marple replied promptly, "You, Carrie Louise. What about me? Tell me, honestly, is there anything here that worries you?" "Worries me?" The other woman raised wondering, clear blue eyes. "But, Jane, what should worry me?" "Well, most of us have worries." Miss Marple's eyes twinkled a little. "I have. Slugs, you know. And the difficulty of getting linen properly darned. And not being able to get sugar candy for making my damson gin. Oh, lots of little things. It seems unnatural that you shouldn't have any worries at all." "Well, I suppose I must have, really," said Mrs. Sericold vaguely. "Oh, Lewis works too hard, and Stephen forgets his meals slaving at the theatre, and Gina's very jumpy. But I've never been able to alter people. I don't see how you can. So it wouldn't be any good worrying, would it?" "Mildred's not very happy either, is she?" "Oh, no," said Carrie Louise. "Mildred is never happy. She wasn't as a child. It was quite unlike Pippo, who was always radiant." "Perhaps," suggested Miss Marple, "Mildred had cause not to be happy."
Carrie Louise said quietly, "Because of being jealous? Yes, I dare say. But people don't really need a cause for feeling what they do feel. They're just made that way, don't you think so, Jane?" Miss Marple thought briefly of Miss Moncrief, a slave to her tyrannical mother. Poor Miss Moncrief, who longed for travel and to see the world, and of how St. Mary Mead, in a decorous way, had rejoiced when Mrs. Moncrief was laid in the churchyard, and Miss Moncrief, with a nice little income, was free at last. And of how Miss Moncrief, starting on her travels, had got no further than Hyères, where, calling to see one of her mother's oldest friends, she'd been so moved by the plight of an elderly hypochondriac that she'd cancelled her travel reservations and taken up her abode in the villa, to be bullied, overworked, and to long wistfully once more for the joys of a wider horizon. Miss Marple said, "Yes, I expect you're right, Carrie Louise. Of course, my being so free from cares is partly due to Jolly. Dear Jolly, she came to me when Johnny and I were just married and was wonderful from the first. She takes care of me as though I were a baby and quite helpless. She'd do anything for me. I feel quite ashamed sometimes. Yeah, I really do believe that Jolly would murder someone for me, Jane. I mean, isn't that an awful thing to say?" "She's certainly very devoted," agreed Miss Marple. "Oh, she gets so indignant," Mrs. Sericold's silvery laugh rang out. "She'd like me to be always ordering wonderful clothes and surrounding myself with luxuries, and she thinks everybody ought to put me first and dance attendance on me. She's the one person who's absolutely unimpressed by Lewis's enthusiasm. All our poor boys are, in her view, pampered young criminals and not worth taking trouble over. She thinks this place is damp and bad for my rheumatism, and that I ought to go to Egypt or somewhere warm and dry. Do you suffer much from rheumatism?" "Well, it's got much worse lately. I find it difficult to walk. Horrid cramps in my legs. Oh, well." Again there came that bewitching elfin smile. "Age must tell." Miss Beliver came out of the French windows and hurried across to them. "A telegram, Cara. Just come over the telephone. Arriving this afternoon, Christian Gulbranson." "Christian?" Carrie Louise looked very surprised. "I'd no idea he was in England." "The Oak Suite, I suppose." "Oh, yes, please, Jolly. Then there'll be no stairs." Miss Beliver nodded and turned back to the house. "Christian Gulbranson is my stepson," said Carrie Louise. "Eric's eldest son. Actually, he's 2 years older than I am. He's one of the trustees of the Institute, the principal trustee. Oh, how very annoying that Lewis is away. Christian hardly ever stays longer than one night. He's an immensely busy man, and there are sure to be so many things they would want to discuss." Christian Gulbranson arrived that afternoon in time for tea. He was a big, heavy-featured man with a slow, methodical way of talking. He greeted Carrie Louise with every sign of affection. "And how is our little Carrie Louise? You do not look a day older. What a day." His hands on her shoulders, he stood smiling down at her. A hand tugged his sleeve. "Christian!" "Ah!" He turned. "It is Mildred? How are you, Mildred?"
"I've not been at all well lately."
"Oh, that is bad, that is bad." There was a strong resemblance between Christian Gulbranson and his half-sister Mildred. There was nearly 30 years difference in age, and they might easily have been taken for father and daughter. Mildred herself seemed particularly pleased by his arrival. She was flushed and talkative, and had talked repeatedly during the day of my brother Christian, my brother Mr. Gulbranson. "And how is little Gina?" said Gulbranson, turning to that young woman. "You and your husband are still here, then?"
"Yes, we've quite settled down, haven't we, Wally?"
"Well, looks like it," said Wally. Gulbranson's small, shrewd eyes seemed to sum up Wally quickly. Wally, as usual, looked sullen and unfriendly. "So,
"Here I am with all the family again," said Gulbrandsen. His voice displayed a rather determined geniality, but in actual fact, Miss Marple thought, he was not feeling particularly genial. There was a grim set to his lips and a certain preoccupation in his manner. Introduced to Miss Marple, he had swept a keen look over her as though measuring and appraising this newcomer. "We'd no idea you were in England, Christian," said Mrs. Sericold.
"No, I came over rather unexpectedly."
"It is too bad that Lewis is away. How long can you stay?"
"I meant to go tomorrow. When will Lewis be back?"
"Oh, tomorrow afternoon or evening."
"It seems then that I must stay another night."
"Oh, if only you'd let us know."
"My dear Carrie Louise, my arrangements, they were made very suddenly."
"You will stay to see Lewis?"
"Yes, it is necessary that I see Lewis."
Miss Belliver said to Miss Marple, "Mr. Gulbrandsen and Mr. Sericold are both trustees of the Gulbrandsen Institute. The others are the Bishop of Cromer and Mr. Guilfoy." Presumably, then, it was on business concerned with the Gulbrandsen Institute that Christian Gulbrandsen had come to Stony Gates. It seemed to be assumed so by Miss Belliver and everyone else, and yet Miss Marple wondered. Once or twice, the old man cast a thoughtful, puzzled look at Carrie Louise when she was not aware of it. A look that puzzled Carrie Louise's watching friend. From Carrie Louise, he shifted his gaze to the others, examining them one and all with a kind of covert appraisal that seemed distinctly odd. After tea, Miss Marple withdrew tactfully from the others to the library, but rather to her surprise, when she had settled herself with her knitting, Christian Gulbrandsen came in and sat down beside her.
"You are a very old friend, I think, of our dear Carrie Louise," he said.
"We were at school together in Italy, Mr. Gulbrandsen, many years ago."
"Ah, yes. And you are fond of her?"
"Oh, yes, indeed," said Miss Marple warmly.
"So, I think, is everyone." "Yes, I truly think that." "It should be so, for she is a very dear and enchanting person. Always, since my father married her, I and my brothers have loved her very much. She has been to us like a very dear sister. She was a faithful wife to my father and loyal to all his ideas. She has never thought of herself, but put the welfare of others first."
"She's always been an idealist," said Miss Marple.
"An idealist?" "Yes. Yes, that is so. And therefore it may be that she does not truly appreciate the evil that there is in the world." Miss Marple looked at him, surprised. His face was very stern. "Tell me," he said, "how is her health?"
Again Miss Marple felt surprised. "Well, she seems to me very well, apart from arthritis or rheumatism."
"Rheumatism?" "Yes. And her heart? Her heart is good?"
"As far as I know."
Miss Marple was still more surprised.
"But until yesterday I had not seen her for many years. If you want to know the state of her health, you should ask somebody in the house here. Miss Belliver, for instance."
"Miss Belliver, yes. Miss Belliver. Or Mildred?"
"Or, as you say, Mildred." Miss Marple was faintly embarrassed. Christian Gulbrandsen was staring at her very hard.
"There is not between the mother and daughter a very great sympathy, would you say?"
"No, I don't think there is."
"I agree. It is a pity. Her only child, but there it is. Now, this Miss Belliver, you think, is really attached to her?"
"Oh, very much so."
"And Carrie Louise leans on this Miss Belliver?"
"I think so." Christian Gulbrandsen was frowning. He spoke as though more to himself than to Miss Marple.
"There is the little Gina, but she is so young. It is difficult.
He broke off. "Sometimes," he said simply, "it is hard to know what is best to be done. I wish very much to act for the best. I am particularly anxious that no harm and no unhappiness should come to that dear lady. But it is not easy. Not easy at all."
Mrs. Street came into the room at that moment. "Oh, there you are, Christian. We were wondering where you were. Dr. Maverick wants to know if you'd like to go over anything with him."
"That is the new young doctor here. No, no. I will wait until Lewis returns."
"He's waiting in Lewis's study. Shall I tell him?"
"I will have a word with him myself."
Goldbranson hurried out. Mildred Street stared after him, and then stared at Miss Marple. "I wonder if anything's wrong. Christian is very unlike himself. Did he say anything?"
"He only asked me about your mother's health."
"Her health? Why should he ask you about that?"
Mildred spoke sharply, her large square face flushing unbecomingly.
"Well, I really don't know. Your mother's health's perfectly good. Surprisingly so for a woman of her age. Much better than mine, as far as that goes."
She paused a moment before saying, "I hope you told him so."
"Well, I don't really know anything about it," said Miss Marple. "He asked me about her heart."
"Her heart?"
"Yes."
"There's nothing wrong with Mother's heart. Nothing at all."
"Well, I'm delighted to hear you say so, my dear. What on earth put all these queer ideas into Christian's head?"
"I've no idea," said Miss Marple.
Chapter 7. The next day passed uneventfully to all appearances, yet to Miss Marple it seemed that there were signs of an inner tension. Christian Goldbranson spent his morning with Dr. Maverick in going round the Institute and in discussing the general results of the Institute's policy. In the early afternoon, Gina took him for a drive, and after that Miss Marple noticed that he induced Miss Bellever to show him something in the gardens. It seemed to her that it was a pretext for ensuring a tête-à-tête with that grim woman company, since the latter dealt only with the domestic side of Stonygates. But in all this, Miss Marple could tell herself she was being fanciful. The one really disturbing incident of the day happened about 4 o'clock. She had rolled up her knitting and gone out into the garden to take a little stroll before tea. Rounding a straggling rhododendron, she came upon Edgar Lawson, who was striding along muttering to himself and who nearly ran into her. He said, "I beg your pardon," hastily, but Miss Marple was startled by the queer, staring expression in his eyes. "Aren't you feeling well, Mr. Lawson?"
"Well? How should I be feeling well? I've had a shock. Terrible shock."
"What kind of a shock?" The young man gave a swift glance past her, and then a sharp, uneasy glance to either side. His doing so gave Miss Marple a nervous feeling. "Shall I tell you?" He looked at her doubtfully. "I don't know. I don't really know. I've been so spied upon." Miss Marple made up her mind. She took him firmly by the arm. "If we walk down this path, there, now, there are no trees or bushes near. Nobody can overhear."
"No, no, you're right."
He drew a deep breath, bent his head, and almost whispered his next words.
"I've made a discovery. A terrible discovery."
Edgar Lawson began to shake all over. He was almost weeping.
"To have trusted someone, to have believed. And it was lies, all lies, lies to keep me from finding out the truth. I can't bear it. It's too wicked. You see, he was the one person I trusted, and now to find out that all the time he's been at the bottom of it all, it's he who's been mine enemy. It's he who's been having me followed about and spied on. But he can't get away with it any more. I shall speak out. I shall tell him I know what he's been doing."
"Who is he?" demanded Miss Marple. Edgar Lawson drew himself up to his full height. He might have looked pathetic and dignified, but actually he only looked ridiculous.
"I am speaking of my father."
"Who Viscount Montgomery, or do you mean Winston Churchill? Edgar threw her a glance of scorn. They let me think that, just to keep me from guessing the truth, but I know now. I've got a friend, a real friend, a friend who tells me the truth and lets me know just how I've been deceived. Well, my father will have to reckon with me. I'll throw his lies in his face. I'll challenge him with the truth. We'll see what he's got to say to that. And suddenly, breaking away, Edgar went off at a run and disappeared in the park. Her face grave, Miss Marple went back to the house. "We're all a little mad, dear lady," Dr. Maverick had said. But it seemed to her that in Edgar's case, it went rather further than that. Louis Sericold arrived back at 6:30. He stopped the car at the gates and walked to the house through the park. Looking out of her window, Miss Marple saw Christian Gulbranson go out to meet him, and the two men, having greeted one another, turned and paced to and fro up and down the terrace. Miss Marple had been careful to bring her bird glasses with her. At this moment, she brought them into action. Was there or was there not a flight of siskins by that far clump of trees? She noted, as the glasses swept down before rising, that both men were looking seriously disturbed. Miss Marple leant out a little farther. Scraps of conversation floated up to her now and then. If either of the men should look up, it would be quite clear that an enraptured bird-watcher had her attention fixed on a point far removed from their conversation. "How to spare Carrie Louise the knowledge?" Gulbranson was saying. The next time they passed below, Louis Sericold was speaking. "If it can be kept from her, I agree that it is she who must be considered." Other faint snatches came to the listener. "Really serious. Not justified. Too big a responsibility to take. We should perhaps take outside advice." Finally, Miss Marple heard Christian Gulbranson say, "Ah, it grows cold. We must go inside." Miss Marple drew her head in through the window with a puzzled expression. What she had heard was too fragmentary to be easily pieced together, but it served to confirm that vague apprehension that had been gradually growing upon her and about which Ruth Van Rydock had been so positive. Whatever was wrong at Stony Gates, it definitely affected Carrie Louise. Dinner that evening was a somewhat constrained meal. Both Gulbranson and Louis were absent-minded and absorbed in their own thoughts. Walter Hudd glowered even more than usual, and for once Gina and Stephen seemed to have little to say either to each other or to the company at large. Conversation was mostly sustained by Dr. Maverick, who had a lengthy technical discussion with Mr. Baumgarten, one of the occupational therapists. When they moved into the hall after dinner, Christian Gulbranson excused himself almost at once. He said he had an important letter to write. "So, if you will forgive me, dear Carrie Louise, I will go now to my room." "You have all you want there, Jolly?" "Oh, yes, yes, everything. A typewriter, I asked, and one has been put there. Miss Bellever has been most kind and attentive." He left the great hall by the door on the left, which led past the foot of the main staircase and along a corridor, at the end of which was a suite of bedroom and bathroom. When he had gone out, Carrie Louise said, "Not going down to the theatre tonight, Gina?" The girl shook her head. She went over and sat by the window, overlooking the front drive and the court. Stephen glanced at her, then strolled over to the big grand piano. He sat down at it and strummed very softly, a queer, melancholy little tune. The two occupational therapists, Mr. Baumgarten and Mr. Lacey, and Dr. Maverick, said good night and left. Walter turned on the switch of a reading lamp, and with a crackling noise, half the lights in the hall went out. He growled, "Ah, that darn switch is always faulty. I'll go and put a new fuse in." He left the hall, and Carrie Louise murmured, "Wally's so clever with electrical gadgets and things like that. You remember how he fixed that toaster?" "It seems to be all he does do here," said Mildred Street.
Mother, have you taken your tonic? Miss Beliver looked annoyed.
Well, I declare I completely forgot tonight.
She jumped up and went into the dining room, returning presently with a small glass containing a little rose-coloured fluid. Smiling a little, Carrie Louise held out an obedient hand.
Oh, such horrid stuff, and nobody lets me forget it, she said, making a wry face.
And then, rather unexpectedly, Louis Sericold said, I don't think I should take it tonight, my dear. I'm not sure it really agrees with you. Quietly, but with that controlled energy always so apparent in him, he took the glass from Miss Beliver and put it down on the big oak Welsh dresser. Miss Beliver said sharply, Well, really, Mr. Sericold, I can't agree with you there. Mrs. Sericold has been very much better since... She broke off and turned sharply. The front door was pushed violently open and allowed to swing to with a crash. Edgar Lawson came into the big, dim hall with the air of a star performer making a triumphal entry. He stood in the middle of the floor and struck an attitude. It was almost ridiculous, but not quite ridiculous. Edgar said theatrically, So I have found you, O mine enemy. He said it to Louis Sericold. Mr. Sericold looked mildly astonished. Why, Edgar, what is the matter?
You can say that to me, you? You know what's the matter. You've been deceiving me, spying on me, working with my enemies against me.
Louis took him by the arm.
Now, now, my dear lad, don't excite yourself. Now tell me all about it quietly. Come into my office.
He led him across the hall and through a door on the right, closing it behind him. After he had done so, there was another sound, the sharp sound of a key being turned in the lock. Miss Beliver looked at Miss Marple, the same idea in both their minds. It was not Louis Sericold who had turned the key. Miss Beliver said sharply,
That young man is just about to go off his head, in my opinion. It isn't safe.
Mildred said,
He's a most unbalanced young man, and absolutely ungrateful for everything that's been done for him. You ought to put your foot down, Mother.
With a faint sigh, Carrie Louise murmured, Oh, there's really no harm in him. He's fond of Louis. He's very fond of him. Miss Marple looked at her curiously. There had been no fondness in the expression that Edgar had turned on Louis Sericold a few minutes previously, very far from it. She wondered, as she'd wondered before, if Carrie Louise deliberately turned her back on reality. Gina said sharply, He had something in his pocket. Edgar, I mean. Playing with it. Stephen murmured as he took his hands from the keys. In a film, it would certainly have been a revolver. Miss Marple coughed.
I think you know, she said apologetically, it was a revolver.
From behind the closed door of Lewis's office, the sound of voices had been plainly discernible. Now, suddenly, they became clearly audible. Edgar Lawson shouted, whilst Louis Sericold's voice kept its even, reasonable note.
Lies! 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 All lies! You're my father! I'm your son! You've deprived me of my rights! I ought to own this place! You hate me! You want to get rid of me!
There was a soothing murmur from Louis, and then the hysterical voice rose still higher. It screamed out foul epithets. Edgar seemed rapidly losing control of himself. Occasionally words came from Louis. Now, calm, just be calm. You know none of this is true. But they seemed not to soothe, but on the contrary, to enrage the young man still further. Insensibly, everyone in the hall was silent, listening intently to what went on behind the locked door of Louis's study.
"'I'll make you listen to me!' yelled Edgar. "'I'll take that supercilious expression off your face. "'I'll have revenge, I tell you, revenge for all you've made me suffer!'
The other voice came curtly, unlike Lewis's usual unemotional tones.
"'Put that revolver down!'
Gina cried sharply.
"'Well, Edgar will kill him. He's crazy. "'Well, can't we get the police or something?'
Carrie Louise, still unmoved, said softly,
There's no need to worry, Gina. Edgar loves Louis. He's just dramatizing himself, that's all.
Edgar's voice sounded through the door in a laugh that Miss Marple had to admit sounded definitely insane.
Ah, yes, I've got a revolver, and it's loaded. No, don't. Don't speak. Don't move. You are going to hear me out. It's you who started this conspiracy against me, and now you're going to pay for it.
What sounded like the report of a firearm made them all start, but Carrie Louise said, "No, it's all right. It's outside in the park somewhere." Behind the locked door, Edgar was raving in a high, screaming voice.
"You sit there looking at me, pretending to be unmoved. Why don't you get down on your knees and beg for mercy? I'm going to shoot, I tell you, I'm going to shoot. Shoot you dead. I am your son, your unacknowledged, despised son. You want me hidden away, out of the world altogether, perhaps. You set your spies to follow me, to hound me down. You plotted against me. You, my father, my father. I'm only a bastard, aren't I? Only a bastard. You went on filling me up with lies, pretending to be kind to me, and all the time, you're not fit to live. I won't let you live."
Again there came a stream of obscene profanity. Somewhere during the scene, Miss Marple was conscious of Miss Belliver saying, "We must do something," and leaving the hall. Edgar seemed to pause for breath, and then he shouted out,
"You're going to die! To die! You're going to die now! Take that, you devil! And that!"
Two sharp cracks rang out, not in the park this time, but definitely behind the locked door. Somebody, Miss Marple thought it was Mildred, cried out, "Oh, God, what shall we do?" Then there was a thud from inside the room, and then a sound almost more terrible than what had gone before, the sound of slow, heavy sobbing. Somebody strode past Miss Marple and started shaking and rattling the door. It was Stephen Resterick.
"Open the door! Open the door!" he shouted.
Miss Belliver came back into the hall. In her hand, she held an assortment of keys. "I try some of these," she said breathlessly. At that moment, the fused lights came on again. The hall sprang into life again after its eerie dimness. Stephen Resterick began trying the keys. They heard the inside key fall out as he did so. Inside, that wild, desperate sobbing went on. Walter Hudd, coming back lazily into the hall, stopped dead and demanded,
"Say, what's going on round here?"
And Mildred said tearfully,
"Oh, that awful crazy young man has shot Mr. Sericold." "Oh, please."
It was Carrie Louise who spoke. She got up and came across to the study door. Very gently, she pushed Stephen Resterick aside. "Now, let me speak to him." She called very softly, "Edgar? Edgar? Let me in, will you? Please, Edgar." They heard the key fitted into the lock. It turned, and the door was slowly opened. But it was not Edgar who opened it. It was Louis Sericold. He was breathing hard as though he had been running, but otherwise he was unmoved.
"It's all right, dearest," he said. "Dearest, it's quite all right."
"We thought you'd been shot," said Miss Belliver gruffly.
Louis Sericold frowned. He said with a trifle of asperity,
"Of course I haven't been shot."
They could see into the study by now. Edgar Lawson had collapsed by the desk. He was sobbing and gasping. The revolver lay on the floor where it had dropped from his hand.
"But we heard shots," said Mildred.
"Oh, yes, he fired twice."
"And he missed you?"
"Of course he missed me," snapped Lewis.
Miss Marple did not consider there was any "of course" about it. The shots must have been fired at fairly close range. Louis Sericold said irritably,
"Now, where's Maverick? It's Maverick we need."
Miss Belliver said,
"Now, I'll get him. Shall I ring up the police as well?"
"Police? Certainly not."
"Well, of course we must ring up the police," said Mildred. "He's dangerous."
"Nonsense," said Louis Sericold. "Poor lad. Does he look dangerous?" At the moment, he did not look dangerous. He looked young and pathetic and rather repulsive. His voice had lost its carefully acquired accent.
I didn't mean to do it, he groaned. I don't know what came over me talking all that stuff. I must have been mad.
Mildred sniffed.
I really must have been mad. I didn't mean to. Please, Mr. Cerakold, I really didn't mean to.
Louis Cerakold patted him on the shoulder. That's all right, my boy. No damage done.
But I might have killed you, Mr. Cerakold.
Walter Hudd walked across the room and peered at the wall behind the desk.
The bullets went in here, he said.
His eye dropped to the desk and the chair behind it.
Must have been a near miss, he said grimly.
Now, I lost my head. I didn't rightly know what I was doing. I thought he'd done me out of my rights. I thought...
Miss Marple put in the question she had been wanting to ask for some time. Who told you, she asked, that Mr. Cerakold was your father? Just for a second, a sly expression peeped out of Edgar's distracted face. It was there and gone in a flash. Nobody, he said.
I just got into my head.
Walter Hudd was staring down at the revolver where it lay on the floor.
Where the hell'd you get that gun? He demanded.
Gun?
Edgar stared down at it.
Looks mighty like my gun, said Walter.
He stooped down and picked it up.
By heck it is! You took it out of my room, you creeping louse, you!
Louis Cerakold interposed between the cringing Edgar and the menacing American.
All this can be gone into later, he said.
Ah, here's Maverick. Take a look at him, will you, Maverick?
Dr. Maverick advanced upon Edgar with a kind of professional zest.
This won't do, Edgar, he said. This won't do, you know. He's a dangerous lunatic, said Mildred sharply. He's been shooting off a revolver and raving. He only just missed my stepfather.
Edgar gave a little yelp, and Dr. Maverick said reprovingly, Careful, please, Mrs. Street.
I'm sick of all this. Sick of the way you all go on here. I tell you, this man is a lunatic.
With a bound, Edgar wrenched himself away from Dr. Maverick and fell to the floor at Cerakold's feet.
Oh, help me. Help me. Don't let them take me away and shut me up. Don't let them.
An unpleasing scene, Miss Marple thought.
Mildred said angrily, I tell you, he's a...
Her mother said soothingly, Oh, please, Mildred, not now. He's suffering. Walter muttered,
Suffering, cripes, they're all cuckoo round here.
Now, I'll take charge of him, said Dr. Maverick.
You come with me, Edgar.
Bed and a sedative, and we'll talk everything over in the morning. Now you trust me, don't you?
Rising to his feet and trembling a little, Edgar looked doubtfully at the young doctor, and then at Mildred Street.
She said, I was a lunatic.
No, no, you're not a lunatic.
Miss Belliver's footsteps rang purposefully across the hall. She came in with her lips pursed together and a flushed face.
I've telephoned the police, she said grimly. They will be here in a few minutes.
Carrie Louise cried, Jolly! In tones of dismay. Edgar uttered a wail. Louis Cerakold frowned angrily.
I told you, Jolly, I did not want the police summoned. This is a medical matter.
Well, that's as may be, said Miss Belliver.
I've my own opinion, but I had to call the police. Mr. Gulbranson's been shot dead.